This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Jennifer Egan about her new novel.
My curiosity was caught by one person after another, and I just followed the trail of my own curiosity.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Christopher Hitchens discusses Philip Pullman's New Life of Jesus Christ.
They're only moral on the condition that he is the Son of God and was crucified, dead, and buried, and is coming back. Don't believe that. The Bible is gibberish.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. With every new novel, Jennifer Egan is emerging as one of our very best novelists. Her latest is called A Visit from the Goon Squad. It's reviewed on our cover by Will Blythe, who calls it a remarkable new fiction, often darkly, rippingly funny. He says Egan possesses a satirist's eye and a romance novelist's heart, and she has perfect pitch. I'm delighted that Jennifer Egan is here to talk about her new novel. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Let's start with one of our two main characters. I guess we could call her a heroine. She's also a klepto. We meet her in the first chapter. Who is she?
Her name is Sasha, and we meet her in a ladies' room at a fancy hotel where she's just spotted a wallet underneath a sink and realizes that the wallet's owner is actually in the bathroom stall, and she takes it and leaves the bathroom. And when I began this book, which really began with that moment, that was really all I knew about her. I just knew that she was a person who took a wallet and walked out the door of the bathroom. And in a way, the whole book spun out from that. I quickly realized as I was writing that she was having her first meeting with a guy she'd met online. So she's actually on a date.
This is Alex.
Right. Yes, her date. The date is not going well, but she gets a kind of charge from having taken the wallet that immediately turns the date around. She's feeling kind of excited and jittery in a good way.
Well, they go back to her apartment, right? And they see – I don't want to give too much away, but it's only the beginning of the novel. On a table, there are all kinds of items that she has collected.
Yes. She doesn't really think of it as stealing. She calls it lifting, and she only likes to take things from people. She doesn't actually steal from stores. So there's something sort of strange going on there in her mind. And she does take a little something from Alex, not a big thing, but kind of a symbolic thing. She also, in the course of that first chapter, runs into the person whose wallet she's stolen. And the real drama of that first part is the confrontation between these two women. In the course of writing that first chapter, I mentioned in passing that Sasha had been regaling her date, or trying to, with tales of her former boss, and his name is Benny Salazar. And I wrote that she tells her date that he sprinkles gold flakes into his coffee and sprays pesticide in his armpits. He's a record producer. And at the time, I just intended that as kind of an amusing thumbnail sketch of a decadent music producer. But then I found myself thinking, so who does those things and why? And I began the next chapter about Benny Salazar, her boss, and it takes place earlier when Sasha still works for him. So we've had this kind of crazy view into her inner life as a person who is compelled to steal. Then we just meet her in the role of assistant in the course of Benny's rather wild flailings as he deals with divorce and various other problems, and indeed is spraying pesticide in his armpits and sprinkling gold into his coffee.
Well, and then as the novel proceeds, as Will Blythe says, not to alarm listeners, but to entice them, you do something very bold here, which is to spin the story out in many different directions following different characters. Who are some of the others?
Let's see. Well, later we meet one of Sasha's children, actually. So that story takes place in the future. And the 12-year-old girl keeps her journal of family life in the form of PowerPoint. So there's a 76-slide PowerPoint presentation, which is this 12-year-old's journal describing her family life in the California desert. There's a disgraced publicist named Dolly, who has caused a huge amount of trouble at a gigantic party she gave, but now is trying to make ends meet by basically going on a retainer with a despot to try to revive his reputation and make him seem nice. And let's see, we meet Alex, the date, Sasha's date from the first chapter many years later when he's approaching middle age. So what I was really interested in was trying to move through time and work with that difference between private and public. You know, we see people and they seem to be easily categorizable. Sometimes they seem like types. And I loved then taking that person that we had seen peripherally and showing us that person's inner life in a really immediate way. And I tried to do that as much as possible. And at the same time, capture those surprises that we have when time passes and we suddenly realize that somehow we always experience it as a surprise, even though it's happening all the time and very gradual. But just that shock of realizing that time has passed and everyone and everything is a little different.
And Jennifer, something our reviewer Will Blythe points out is that this is a book that's very carefully poised between being linked stories on the one hand and a more traditional novel on the other. How do you strike that balance so that these different voices and these this passage through time is connected?
Well, it happened very organically because, as I said, I was just – my curiosity was caught by one person after another, and I just followed the trail of my own curiosity. Ultimately, I was not sure how I should organize this. I tried not to worry about the question of whether it was stories or a novel because those are really just categories. They're marketing categories. So I tried to put that to the side. Once I realized that the book was emerging in this peripatetic way, I set up three ground rules which guided me. Number one was that each chapter had to be about a different person. So someone could only be the subject once. People reappear many times, but they can only be the subject once. Number two is that each chapter has to have a very different feel, and that I achieve mostly through different technical choices. So one chapter is in the second person. One chapter is told as a celebrity profile. I mentioned the PowerPoint. I tried to just do as many things as I could technically to give each chapter a completely different feel. And finally, each chapter had to stand completely on its own and not require anything around it to exist, to work as a unit.
Didn't one chapter appear in The New Yorker?
Three actually did over the years. Yeah, a number of them were published.
As separate stories. I remember reading one and thinking this was a short story you'd written.
I guess I felt like it was worth sending those out because I thought, look, they're supposed to stand on their own legs. Let them go out there and do that. And yet they all have this secret life, which is about the way that they interweave and connect. So anyway, so I really hewed to those principles, and it resulted in my having to leave out a bunch of stuff that I would have loved to include. I mean, there were a number of chapters that I just couldn't make work. I couldn't make them meet all of those criteria.
Chapters you completed, that you wrote complete drafts of?
Tried. Oh, yeah. Worked on for months, actually. Certain peripheral characters that I really wanted to break open and make available for the reader, but I couldn't do it without either repeating myself in terms of the world and the feel of the chapter, or I couldn't really make them stand up without the stuff around them. They didn't finally work. I tried a couple of times to write a second chapter about the same person that I had before, so I tried breaking that rule. It didn't work. I somehow had to hold to those rules.
Thanks a lot, Jennifer.
My pleasure.
It's Jennifer Egan, whose new novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Tinkers by Paul Harding, winner of the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Publishers Weekly describes it as an especially gorgeous example of novelistic craftsmanship. That's Tinkers by Paul Harding, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So publishing is kind of like the movie business these days, right? We have the big summer blockbusters, popular entertainment in many respects. Is that right?
Yes. June and July and to some extent August are when the big publishers come out with a lot of books that are sequels and by familiar authors and books that they, of course, hope that people will tote along with them to the beach. Some of those authors, we have a Carl Hiaasen book. There's Janet Ivanovich, who has a new novel.
And this is a Stephanie Plum series. Is
yes.
that right?
Brad Easton Ellis has a book called Imperial Bedrooms, which is the sequel to Less Than Zero. There's another Jason Bourne book, which is on shelves now. So I think the publishers are hoping that readers will see a familiar title, a familiar author, and bet that it'll be worth their money.
And Stieg Larsson seems to be the guy right now.
He is. Those books are not going anywhere. From booksellers that I've talked to have said that some people are just getting turned on to the series right now. So you have all three books are out. Two of the first are in paperback. And the third book is in hardback, which just came out in May. So a lot of people are just kind of starting the beginning, and some people have finished the third one and are now just hoping that unpublished, unfinished manuscript will somehow find its way.
Yeah, how about you? Are you a Stieg Larsson reader?
I am. I've read all three of them, and I really enjoyed them. I've been recommending them to people. But there is something very cultish about them. You know, you see people reading them on the subway, and there's something about being in a club when you read them. And the character of Elizabeth Salander is a very cool, complex, very interesting character and completely unique.
So she's the heroine. And very briefly, who is she? What does she do?
She lives in Sweden, as all the other characters do, and she's a computer hacker who also happens to have tattoos and piercings, and she's sort of a punk, and she has been in many violent ways victimized by men throughout her life, including her own father. The story is, in all three books, is really about her quest for justice, the way that she fights back, and the people along the way who help her do that.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Philip Pullman is one of the best-selling and best-known writers alive, best known for his dark materials. He's now written an unusual narrative. It's called The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. It's reviewed for us this week by the great Christopher Hitchens, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Christopher.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're a big Pullman fan, but not necessarily of this particular book.
No, I like Pullman's fiction for its muscularity and unsentimentality and the way that it spoke to children in non-condescending terms about the extreme unlikelihood or undesirability, actually, of there being a supernatural dimension, a celestial dictatorship that we didn't have the power to change. In fact, his books end with finding someone, some entity claiming to be God and putting it painlessly out of its misery. So that's pretty radical. And I thought praiseworthy for that reason. In his new novel, he does something that quite a lot of people have tried to do, which I regard as a soft option, which is to say, well, Christianity is fine and Jesus was a wonderful person, but it's just that it's been perverted by the churches. It's organized religion we don't like. That's the usual bolt hole that people flee to, as you must have noticed. And I think that's a distinction without very much difference. Either there is a God who can make a human sacrifice out of his son. A very horrible thought when you think about it. I mean, God, the Old Testament, God even stops Abraham from doing that. And that by some mysterious osmosis, this is redemptive, this torture death is redemptive for us, born long after it, who would have tried to stop it if we could. Either that's a moral tale or it is not. In my opinion, it's a very immoral tale.
In fact, you quote C.S. Lewis, of all people, saying to believe in the literal Jesus as he did is to accept him as a kind of lunatic.
Yes. I mentioned – I give about two or three citations. I mean, Thomas Jefferson took this view in his famous Jefferson Bible, which excises all the supernatural claims and just leaves you with the Sermon on the Mount and a few parables and doesn't accept the divinity of Jesus but says great teachings. Ernest Renan in his Vie de Jésus says much the same. C.S. Lewis, I think, is more honest when he says, look, this is a cop-out. If this man isn't the Son of God, then his teachings would be evil because they tell you that the world is coming to an end, you should abandon your family, give no thought to thrift or investment or architecture or anything of the sort. It's all over. Come and follow me and throw aside everything else. If what you're saying isn't true, if you're just another ranter, another false messiah, then those preachings would obviously be immoral. You can't say, you can't have the one without the other. They're only moral on the condition that he is the Son of God and was crucified, dead and buried, and is coming back. If you don't believe that, the Bible is gibberish. I think that's the most honest thing C.S. Lewis ever said. But then that's not in a very strong field, of course.
Now, Pullman narratively has a device that he uses. Explain that.
Well, he postulates, which has been done before, I think the word Didymus actually means twin. And there is, in some accounts, there was a Didymus disciple. At any rate, he allows the Virgin Mary, this is a perfectly good opening device, I think, to give birth to two boys. One of them rather nice, rather naive, rather concerned for others, perhaps a little bit simple-minded, and the other rather crafty and knowing. The nice one is Jesus and the nasty one is Christ. And Christ, in a slightly fratricidal way, tries to egg Jesus on to make more extreme statements and also keeps a private diary of his doings. And I'd be giving away the plot if I said much more, but I should perhaps go one more step. Well, he's approached by a mysterious stranger who appears to know his innermost thoughts and who speaks Greek and who urges him, keep this record because the record may be much more important than the life you're describing. In other words, he's encouraging him to already start writing down a myth that can later be sold to people, whatever happens. And so you have the Bible in a kind of parallel text as condensed and related by Pullman in this way.
In your review, Christopher, you say that Pullman, to your surprise, ends up being a kind of Protestant atheist, I think is your term. What do you mean by that?
It's very clear that the church he's against, because it's said in a very long, heartfelt speech by one of the characters, is the Catholic Church, the church that claims direct apostolic succession from the Nazarene and whose leader, currently Joseph Ratzinger, is deemed to be the vicar of Christ on earth. So it's quite obvious that it's this continuity that he thinks is the most sinister one of all. And rather like a Lutheran reformer, he says, away with all this flummery, away with all this priestcraft, away with all this stained glass and incense and ostentatious wealth and the rest of it, but keep the essence of the thing because that's beautiful. And that I would describe as a Protestant position.
Thanks a lot, Christopher.
My pleasure.
It's Christopher Hitchens, who this week reviews Philip Pullman's new book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, another blow for Stieg Larsson. He is kept out of the number one spot again this week by Janet Ivanovich, who enters with her latest Stephanie Plum mystery. It's called Sizzling 16. Interestingly, she held a naming contest on her website for this book, as she does with a lot of them. And, you know, she had some pretty good options, including Sloppy 16, Tight Jean 16, and my favorite, Latrine 16. But she went with Sizzling 16, and it's the 11th consecutive Stephanie Plum book to enter at number one.
That's impressive.
It is. And she, you know, she may also soon be taking over another list. Later this month, she is releasing her first graphic novel. It's co-written with her daughter, and it's called Troublemaker. And it takes one of her characters, Alex Barnaby, who's a female NASCAR mechanic, and turns her into a comic book character.
A female NASCAR mechanic. Why not? What about the nonfiction list?
Not a lot of news here. It's still Stuff My Dad Says at number one, followed by Anthony Bourdain's Medium Raw. There's only one new book this week. It's S.C. Gwynne's Empire of the Summer Moon. It's, you may remember, we reviewed it on our cover a couple of weeks ago. It's the story of the last and greatest chief of the Comanches. So that was reviewed on our cover alongside Nathaniel Philbrick's book, The Last Stand, about Custer and Sitting Bull. And that's still hanging on at number 10.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.